Picture this. You're standing in your bathroom, right? And you're just staring into the mirror. Stuck to the glass is this brightly colored sticky note. And written on it in bold marker is the phrase, "I am a confident, wealthy success."
Oh, I already know exactly where this is going.
Right. So you take a deep breath, you look yourself in the eye, and you recite it aloud. But instead of this like massive surge of empowerment, your chest just gets super tight. And a highly sarcastic voice in the back of your head whispers, "Yeah, right. Who are we kidding, mate?"
It is such a universal and honestly highly uncomfortable experience. I mean, that tight artificial feeling is something almost everyone who has tried forced positive thinking has encountered.
Yeah, it feels completely counterproductive. And so that's what today's deep dive is dedicated to unpacking. We've got a stack of sources in front of us today, pulling from, you know, top neuroscientific journals, psychology breakdowns, and the work of subconscious reprogramming experts, specifically people like Bruce Lipton.
Which is fascinating material, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. So our mission today is to have a proper squiz of the data and figure out the mechanical reasons why traditional affirmations fail for most people. And more importantly, we're going to explore the actual evidence-grounded methods that rewire the brain. We want to understand what's happening in our hardware to cause that awful tight feeling.
And we should probably be clear from the outset that the goal here is not to, you know, ditch the value of self-improvement.
No, definitely not.
It's really about recognizing the realities of how the brain processes information.
Yeah.
I mean, trying to hack the brain with a few forced words is kind of like trying to update a smartphone by yelling at the screen.
That's a brilliant way to put it. So let's get into the mechanics of it. When you get that tight feeling in front of the mirror, what is actually happening?
Well, you are experiencing cognitive dissonance. This is the severe mental discomfort that occurs when you try to force new information into your mind that directly contradicts your deeply held subconscious beliefs.
So the brain doesn't just like passively accept a statement like, "I am worthy."
No, it actively fights it. If your brain holds years of experiential evidence suggesting that you struggle with self-worth, a psychological mechanism called the backfire effect actually kicks in.
The backfire effect? Wait, so it actually makes things worse?
Exactly. The studies in our sources show that when individuals with low self-esteem repeat heavily positive self-statements like, "I am worthy," or "I am a success," they actually end up feeling significantly worse afterward. The underlying belief is intensified.
Wow. So the affirmation is literally doing the exact opposite of its intended purpose. I really want to understand the mechanics of that. Why does the brain care if we lie to it about something positive? You'd reckon it would welcome the dopamine hit, right?
You would think so, yeah. But the subconscious mind is essentially this highly sophisticated pattern matching system. And it prioritizes consistency over positivity.
Consistency over positivity. Okay.
Right. Maintaining a consistently negative self-image feels safe. It's predictable and it's familiar. Adopting an inconsistently positive one introduces an unknown variable.
And brains hate unknown variables.
They despise them. So when you force a statement you don't actually believe, your brain's error detection system kicks into overdrive. It scanned your memory banks for evidence to evaluate the claim.
And I'm guessing it doesn't find much evidence of being a wealthy success.
Exactly. When it inevitably finds past failures or rejections instead, it uses those memories to aggressively disprove the affirmation.
So it's basically like typing a new password into a computer system, but the system aggressively rejects it and locks you out because it's so used to the old password. And the harder you mash the keyboard trying to force the new one, the more defensive the system gets.
Spot on. By stating something so far from your current accepted reality, you're just highlighting the massive gap between where you are and where you want to be. And that gap generates emotional pain and cognitive friction rather than, you know, actual motivation.
That brings up a really massive power mismatch, though. If our brain is rejecting these new words, we need to look at who is actually driving the bus here. The sources, particularly the work of Bruce Lipton, talk heaps about the conscious versus the subconscious mind.
Yes. Lipton's framing of this is crucial. The division of labor between the two is just staggering.
Right. Because the conscious mind is the part of you that logically decides to read a self-help book, writes the sticky note, and chooses to recite it.
Exactly. But Lipton points out that this conscious part is responsible for roughly 5% of your mental processing. Just 5%.
It's almost nothing.
It is. The other 95% is the subconscious. That's the operating system running your automatic habits, your ingrained self-image, and your immediate emotional reactions.
And guarding the gate between those two is something called the critical mind, right?
Yes. The critical mind acts as a filtering firewall. It compares incoming information from the outside world against the existing beliefs already stored in the subconscious. If the incoming data doesn't match the existing program, it simply bounces it back.
It just rejects it entirely.
Pretty much. Because the subconscious doesn't even comprehend logical, language-based arguments. It does not speak in words.
So how did it get programmed in the first place, then?
It was programmed primarily in early childhood, usually from birth to age 7, through emotion, repeated patterns, and somatic or bodily experiences. Lipton compares the subconscious to a tape player.
Okay, I like that analogy.
Yeah, so you can't change the program on a cassette tape by yelling at the player. You have to actually understand how to hit the record button.
I mean, that makes sense, but I want to push back on this slightly. We hear heaps about neuroplasticity, right? The brain's ability to reorganize itself by forming new neural connections.
Sure, yeah.
If we're so highly evolved and adaptable, why on earth do our brains stubbornly cling to this negative programming? It seems like a massive design flaw that the firewall is so strictly guarded against things that are genuinely objectively good for us.
It's a great question.
Right.
But it really comes down to evolutionary survival. Your brain's primary objective is not to make you happy. Its primary objective is to keep you alive.
Right. Survival over happiness.
Always. We have a system called the default mode network, which is highly active when we're running on autopilot, and it often loops over familiar anxieties or doubts. Paired with that is the amygdala, which is the brain's threat detection center.
And to the amygdala, any change, even a good one, is considered the unknown.
And the unknown is a potential threat. If you have survived up to this point, operating with a baseline belief that you are, say, unworthy or unsafe, the brain decides not to mess with the formula.
Because technically, you're not dead yet.
Exactly. You are alive. So the current programming is deemed successful from a purely biological standpoint. Changing your programming is risky.
So it's not that my brain wants me to be miserable. It's just aggressively trying to protect me, even if it's doing a terrible job of making me feel fulfilled.
That is exactly it. It's misguided protection.
Okay, so if words trigger resistance and the critical mind filters out logical arguments, we have to find a way to speak the language the subconscious actually understands. And our sources suggest that the back door is the physical body.
Yes, this is where the research moves from theory into highly practical application. Because the subconscious speaks the language of experience, we have to use somatic methods.
Somatic meaning relating to the body.
Right. One highly effective method detailed in the sources is behavioral pattern interruption. Because your body and your emotions are inherently linked, you can use physical movement to disrupt a mental loop.
So instead of saying, "I am confident," when doubt creeps in, you physically interrupt the state.
Exactly. You notice a cycle of self-doubt starting, and instead of trying to verbally argue with it, you stand up. You shake your hands vigorously for 10 seconds, or you do a set of jumping jacks.
Okay, I can totally see how that disrupts the spiral when you're alone in your living room. But practically speaking, if I'm in a tense salary negotiation or sitting in a crowded board meeting and doubt creeps in, I can't exactly stand up and do jumping jacks.
Right, that would be a bit awkward.
Yeah, a bit dodgy for your career. So how does this work in the real world?
That's a very fair point. In situations where overt physical movement is impossible, the sources point toward energy psychology and more subtle physiological shifts. Have you heard of modalities like EFT? Or PSYCHK.
EFT is emotional freedom techniques, right? Often called tapping.
Yes, tapping. It's heavily featured in the reprogramming literature. EFT involves tapping on specific acupressure points on the face and body while acknowledging a stressor. And PSYCHK also uses specific physical postures to create a whole brain state.
But what is the actual physiological mechanism behind tapping? Is it just like a distraction technique to get your mind off the anxiety?
The research indicates it goes much deeper than just distraction. Tapping on these specific meridian points actually sends a calming signal directly to the amygdala.
Oh, wow. So it directly targets the threat center.
Yes. If you're experiencing a negative emotion or recalling a limiting belief, your amygdala is firing a threat response. By introducing the physical tapping, you are mechanically disrupting the somatic stress response.
You're basically telling the brain, hey, we are observing this negative thought, but the physical body is totally safe.
Precisely. This allows the cognitive dissonance to process without triggering that awful backfire effect. you are essentially changing the environment in which the thought exists.
That ties perfectly into Hebbian learning, which the psychology breakdowns mention. The whole neurons that fire together, wire together concept.
Yes, you are associating the onset of doubt with physical movement and a physiological calming response, rather than a verbal argument you will inevitably lose.
That makes heaps of sense. And building on that, the sources also outline something called symbolic anchoring.
Oh, anchoring is fantastic.
Yeah, the idea here is to build a genuine physical association with a positive state. But the catch is, you only do it when you naturally feel that way.
But you don't force it.
Exactly. You wait until you genuinely feel calm or focused. Maybe you're just sitting on the couch on a quiet Sunday afternoon. And in that real moment, you anchor it with a specific physical action.
Like touching your thumb to your index finger, or maybe holding a specific smooth stone in your pocket.
Yeah, and you do this consistently, so your nervous system physically links that touch to the feeling of calm. So later, under stress, activating the anchor recalls the state.
Because it's built on a foundation of real experiential evidence, not a fabricated statement.
Right. It's like we're bypassing the bouncer at a club. Instead of arguing with the bouncer at the front door using a fake ID, which is basically what a traditional affirmation is, we're just walking in through the kitchen by carrying a crate of physical evidence.
I love that analogy. You're just walking past the resistance entirely. There's also another way to bypass that bouncer, using micro-identity shifts.
Oh, right. Tell me about those.
Instead of making a grand declaration like, I am a highly organized person, you ask yourself a process question. What would an organized person do right now?
And then you just, like, throw away one piece of rubbish.
Exactly. It bypasses resistance because it's not an identity claim. It's simply a small action. Over time, the subconscious mind updates its self-concept based on mounting behavioral proof.
You're providing undeniable, action-based evidence that slips right under the radar of the critical mind.
Yes. But, you know, while physical pattern interruptions and somatic anchors are great, the sources point out another massive pathway into the subconscious that requires almost zero physical effort.
Which sounds ideal, honestly. We're talking about the altered states of music and sleep, right?
Yes. Melodic reprogramming represents a profound shift in how we approach neuroplasticity. We established earlier that spoken words only hit the language centers of the brain,
making them very easy for the critical mind to filter and reject.
Right. But melody operates entirely differently. When information is delivered through music, it doesn't just process in one area.
The data shows it simultaneously activates the auditory cortex, the emotional centers, the motor cortex, and the memory systems all at once.
And this multi-region activation creates significantly stronger, more durable neural encoding than mere verbal repetition.
Which totally explains why I can remember the lyrics to some random song from decades ago, but I forget a verbal affirmation I literally recited this morning.
Exactly. Melody naturally bypasses the critical mind's filtering process. But the sources take this a step further by exploring how these melodic affirmations are layered with specific healing frequencies.
You mean the solfeggio frequencies, like 528 hertz or 396 hertz? I see frequencies mentioned a lot in wellness spaces, but I've always been a bit skeptical. How does a specific sound wave frequency physically cause the downregulation of the amygdala? What's the actual science there?
It involves the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is a major component of the parasympathetic nervous system.
The rest and digest system.
Right. Certain low-frequency sounds physically stimulate the vagus nerve through the eardrum and the tiny bones in the inner ear. This physical stimulation signals the autonomic nervous system to shift from sympathetic fight or flight mode into that parasympathetic mode.
So the frequency is literally creating a state of physiological calm, opening up the subconscious before the melodic programming even arrives.
Precisely. And this leads us to the absolute most receptive states the human brain can be in, the theta and delta brainwave states.
Which Bruce Lipton talks a lot about regarding hitting the record button.
Yes. When you're awake and alert, your brain operates in beta or alpha states. These are fast frequencies, heavily guarded by the critical mind. But Lipton emphasizes the moments just before you fall asleep and just as you're waking up.
The transition periods.
Exactly. During those windows, your brain activity slows down into the theta state, which is roughly 4 to 8 hertz. In theta, the conscious critical mind essentially goes offline. The firewall drops.
Oh.
Lipton refers to this as the brain's natural hypnagogic state. And this is the exact brainwave state children are predominantly in from birth to age 7.
The sponge phase where all that initial programming was written?
Yes. So by playing reprogramming audio during that specific window, you are literally hitting the record button on the tape player.
Wait, so I can literally just go to sleep, play a track, and bypass the critical mind entirely?
You can. And as you fall deeper into sleep, you enter deep delta sleep, which is between 2 and 4 hertz. The conscious mind is completely absent, but the subconscious remains active.
It's processing the emotional content of the day and solidifying memories, right?
Right. So introducing melodic affirmations during this window allows the subconscious to absorb the programming completely unguarded. It's brilliant.
I mean, I love the idea of using sleep and sound to do the heavy lifting for me. But practically speaking, I can't sleep for 24 hours a day. Eventually, I have to wake up, go to work, and actually speak to myself.
Unfortunately, yes.
So how do we rescue our internal dialogue during the waking hours so we're not just engaging in toxic positivity and triggering the backfire effect all over again?
To do that, we have to leverage another structural component of the brain called the reticular activating system, or the RAS.
The RAS, that acts as a sensory filter, doesn't it?
It does. It sifts through the millions of bits of sensory information bombarding you every second and decides what gets brought to your conscious awareness. It looks for things that validate what you already focus on.
Oh, I know this one. It's like when you buy a red car and suddenly you see red cars everywhere on the road.
Exactly. If you constantly think about how terrible you are at your job, your RAS will actively highlight every minor mistake you make to prove that belief correct.
So according to self-affirmation theory, we can intentionally program the RAS using words, but we just have to construct those words correctly.
Yes. The secret is that the statements must be believable, process-oriented, and deeply tied to your personal core values.
So going back to the mirror, a sticky note that says, "I am a wealthy genius," is out.
Definitely out.
What should that internal dialogue look like instead, then?
It should look like, "I am learning, improving, and taking steps every day to build my financial security."
Because the brain can't argue with, "I am learning."
Exactly. It's a verifiable process, not an absolute identity claim.
The sources reference functional magnetic resonance imaging fMRI scans that track what happens when people use these specific value-based, process-oriented affirmations.
And those fMRI studies are fascinating. Researchers had participants reflect on their future-oriented core values and then measured their brain activity.
What did they find?
They observed significantly increased blood flow to the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, the VMPFC.
The VMPFC. Okay, and what does that part of the brain do?
It's heavily involved in processing rewards and self-valuation. But here's the best part. The researchers also measured the participants' cortisol levels, the primary stress hormone, in their saliva.
Right.
They found a direct mathematical correlation. The higher the activity in the VMPFC generated by these process-oriented statements, the lower the cortisol levels when the participants were later subjected to stressful tasks.
Wow. So the activation in the VMPFC acts as a biological buffer against stress.
It physically protects you from stress.
You are essentially teaching your RAS to start scanning the environment for evidence that you are indeed learning and improving, which lowers your stress response.
Yeah.
You create this positive, self-reinforcing feedback loop.
That's it, exactly. We're not ditching affirmations entirely. We're just evolving them from delusional declarations into realistic, process-driven instructions for our brain's filter.
It's the difference between trying to lie to your own hardware and giving it a set of instructions it can actually compile and execute.
It's a truly holistic approach to neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
You're working with your brain's architecture instead of fighting against it.
All right, let's summarize what we've uncovered today. If you want to actually reprogram your mind, ditch the hollow, forced mirror talk that triggers cognitive dissonance and the backfire effect.
Please take the sticky note off the mirror.
Yes, chuck the sticky note in the bin.
Yeah.
Instead, rely on the physical body to bypass the critical mind. Use subtle pattern interruptions or energy psychology techniques like EFT tapping and PSYCHK to disrupt the somatic stress response.
Build those physical anchors when you naturally feel good.
Exactly. Utilize melodic audio and theta state windows right around sleep to slip past your brain's defensive firewall. And when you do construct your internal dialogue, make the statements process-oriented, like, "I am learning," so your reticular activating system scans for actual evidence of growth.
It requires a bit of a shift in strategy, but the neuroscientific evidence strongly supports these methods over traditional forced positivity.
It really does. Now, before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final, highly provocative thought from the research regarding how heavily our bodies are involved in this whole process.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
We've spent this entire time analyzing the brain in your skull, but you actually have a second brain.
The enteric nervous system.
Located right in your gut, and it communicates constantly with your head brain via the gut-brain axis. Consider this, when you stand in front of that mirror, recite an affirmation you know is false, and you get that tight, awful feeling in your stomach.
That is not just a metaphor?
No. Your gut brain is literally communicating with your head brain, waving a massive red flag, proving that true belief has to be felt in the physical tissue of the body, not just spoken by the mouth.
It's such a powerful reminder that our emotional processing cannot be separated from our physiology. You really cannot outthink your nervous system.
You definitely can't. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We highly encourage you to find a smooth stone for your pocket today, or perhaps cue up some 528 hertz audio as you drift into a theta state tonight.
And the next time you find yourself staring at a sticky note on the bathroom mirror, you'll know exactly why your brain is resisting.
And exactly how to change the conversation. Catch you next time.